Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Curran. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Anthony Zhang, CEO and co-founder of Vinovest, a platform that allows users to invest and own blue chip wines. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Peter, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to be on here.
Yeah, we're excited. I mean, who doesn't like talking and consuming wine?
There you go. That's all I do today.
Well, hopefully you say it's sober for this. But Anthony, maybe to start, you could walk everyone through a little bit about your background and really how you came to co-founding Vinovest.
All right. So I grew up all around the world, spent most of my life in Asia through Beijing and Hong Kong. And then I came back to the States for college. During my freshman year of college, I founded my first business, Envoy Now, which was a food delivery app for college campuses. I took the Thiel Fellowship to drop out of college and take that business full time. And after 4 years of building it and scaling it, I was able to get that acquired by a subsidiary of Walmart. After that first acquisition was when I first started learning more about the investing world, alternative assets in particular. You know, being that I just run and sold a startup, angel investing was really appealing to me. Cryptocurrency was just starting to become more popular. And I remember just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about what assets the ultra wealthy were all investing in. And a lot of the sort of passion assets were at the top of that list in terms of their annualized returns. So I was seeing things like art, wine, whiskey, fine jewelry, classic cars, and wine just really popped out to me because it's always something that I had been interested in. By no means was I a wine enthusiast or expert, but I thought to myself, hey, like this was a really interesting asset class that I could really learn more about, be able to make some profits in. And if I was a bad wine investor, I could just drink a bunch of this wine. It really seemed like a no-loss proposition. So that's really what led me down the rabbit hole to realize that as a 20-something year old kid, you can't really invest in wine. It is not easy. There are a ton of barriers to entry, and I wanted to solve that, not just for myself, but for other retail investors that maybe were just getting started or were not wine experts or just wanted to diversify for exposure's sake. And that's really what Vinovest's mission is. We want to democratize access to investing in these blue chip wines and make it simple and transparent for everybody.
And then maybe just for a second, you could walk everyone through sort of, you know, what Vinovest is and sort of, you know, what people can do and expect to kind of experience on the site.
Yeah, great. So Vinovest has a few different experiences for users. The first product we launched is our managed portfolio product. So this means that you don't need to know anything about wine investing. Say you come in to Vinovest today, Peter, and you're saying, hey, I want to invest a couple $1,000s into wine. I know nothing about wine. We'll then ask you questions like, what's your risk tolerance? How long are you looking to hold this asset for? And based on that, our algorithm, as well as our human expert team, will be able to actually construct a portfolio for you. We'll actually go out and buy those real bottles and cases of wine, and we'll store it and insure it for you in our partner warehouses. So that's our first product. It's for the passive long-term investor. Our second product is a marketplace. So this allows any trader, any investor, any client to be able to buy, sell, transact those wines while all having the guarantee that it's under Vino Best custody, it's authentic wines, and they're in perfect condition. And that's really more for the, I'd say, more active trader or investor that wants to get their own hands a little more dirty and really be able to control their own destiny with their portfolio. So those are the two main offerings that we have for clients today.
I think there's so much to unpack there and a lot of really interesting angles too, just even thinking about the logistics of finding and sourcing wine as much as anything else. But maybe, you know, you kind of mentioned a couple of things up front, especially when you were looking back at the Wall Street Journal article and you mentioned all these, you know, we use a term here and you use it as well, passion assets, really just kind of another way to think about collectibles and things that people mm-hmm. haven't historically, you know, assigned investment rationale behind, but really things that they're very passionate about that we're finding more and more people are really excited about the prospect of trading, you know, collecting, and then potentially, you know, in some instances using, but also sometimes, you know, really using it as an investment vehicle mm-hmm. to hopefully see some appreciation. My question to you is, you know, kind of seeing that Wall Street Journal article where all of these things were all showing really high returns at the same time also leads me to believe that, you know, there's a lot of correlation across all these. So, you know, do you think about all these asset classes as real assets? How do you kind of compartmentalize them in a portfolio outside of just alternatives?
Yeah, that's a great question because not all of these assets are created the same, right? I think when you come to assets like wine and whiskey, right, they've got a special factor to them is that they actually are deflationary, right? Say if year one, a winery releases 10,000 bottles, people are actually consuming those 10,000 bottles as the wine ages. So by year five, maybe there's only 5,000 in circulation. And by year 10, maybe there's only 2,500. So when it reaches, say, the wine's peak drinking period at 15 or 20 years, the supply is so minuscule that it accelerates that supply and demand curve. Other assets, you know, whether it be art or classic cars, people are not going around and destroying pieces of art, right? That would be the equivalent of what's happening. So that's kind of a special factor, that sort of aging process and utility that comes with consumables like wine and whiskey and other sort of things like that. And then when you're talking about classic cars and art, there are other factors that I think make them uncorrelated to wine and whiskey, right? God forbid, an artist dies, right? That's a huge price catalyst. You know, with trading cards, right? Whenever there's a big retirement, or with also if an athlete dies, that's also a big price catalyst. So there are sort of different factors in each of those passion asset markets that lead them to be pretty uncorrelated with each other.
Oh, very cool. Very interesting. So you mentioned also kind of up front, and something that just kind of really interests me is like the logistics of all this. So, you know, you go and you buy a stock, and I think people can very easily compartmentalize that as, you know, being in custody and kind of existing somewhere in a safe place. When you think about going and investing in wine, to your point, some of those barriers to entries, and we'll talk about kind of what all of them are. One of them most certainly is this concept of like, how do you store them and preserve the wine and also make sure that, you know, kind of the ownership is kind of tracked over time in ways that it's very easily for a stock, but really isn't for many other assets. What are some of those kind of logistical things that Vinovest helps solve that really make investing in wine so complicated?
Yeah, that's a great point because I went through all of this banging my head on the door as an individual before I started Vinovest. So first of all, it's determining what to even buy, right? There's not a lot of information out there. There's no Seeking Alpha. There's no investment Reddits or Discords for wine investment today. So after you figure out what wine to even buy, a lot of times you can't get access to them because they're not really available or tradable on a market like a stock is. So next is getting access. Third is coordinating logistics. For example, if somebody lives in the United States and they're looking to buy wine in France, how can they get that to their home? How can they deal with customs? How can they deal with shipping and insurance as well? So finding offshore storage, we use bonded warehouses that allow investors from any country to be able to buy and sell, you know, tax-free, not having any sort of these value-add taxes associated with buying sales tax from other countries. And then also the storage and insurance component, right? That's really important because unlike a stock or a bar of gold, wine and whiskey, those are things that can really be damaged, right? If you don't have the right temperature, right humidity, those can turn into vinegar. They can be useless. And that's really one of the biggest risks in this asset class is lack of proper storage. So we also have a very robust insurance policy with our storage facilities that guarantee the market value of the wine in case there's breakage, in case there's spoilage and things like that. And then the last piece is authentication. Like any sort of luxury asset class, there are a ton of fakes out there, right? There's fake trading cards, there's fake pieces of art. There's also fake bottles of wine. And by having direct relationships with suppliers and with reputable parties, we're able to trace the invoices back to the winery, or in certain cases, we're buying direct from the winery. So that gives us a level of confidence and gives our insurance partners a level of confidence when they are guaranteeing the value of that wine, knowing that what you're buying is actually real, it has resale value, and you're not just buying some, you know, $2 chuck with a different label on it.
And I'm kind of curious, you know, like when you think about just, you know, I want to talk a little bit around, you know, how do you buy and sell, especially in bulk, but also just kind of more outside of the Vino Vest market, if people historically wanted to kind of transact, you know, in wine or, you know, spirits, how would someone go about, you know, previously getting access to either, you know, fine wine? Do they have to buy cases worth? Do they buy individual bottles? How would they even do it as an open market and auction? How else were people previously able to do it? And how limited was that availability?
Yeah. So previously auctions and brokers were the most popular way. So you would go to one of your big auction houses, like a Sotheby's or a Christie's. You know, they hold regularly scheduled wine auctions, and you bid on them. So I've been to a few of these. I think the most striking thing is the commissions that the auction house takes, right? It could be 20%, it could be up to 30% in some cases, and you would be buying the entire case in some cases, or just individual bottles if it's something that's ultra rare. And after that, you kind of be on your own, right? The auction house does its best ability to authenticate the wines, but there are several cases of when that's not the case, and it's kind of like a buyer beware situation. So that is you know, kind of how it's done before. There really is not much of an open market. So say 5 years later, you've held that wine, you're like, hey, I think it's appreciated. You need to take it back to an auction house or take it back to a broker and have them find the suitable buyer for you. When it comes to the bulk market, we're really mainly dealing with the trade. So that means large wine retailers, distributors, you know, maybe restaurants, right? Folks that are looking to buy large sums of wine to be able to resell or to consume.
So you mentioned consume there at the end. And, you know, I just think about the life cycle of, let's say, a bottle of fine wine. You know, it feels to me like people over any amount of time can trade or invest in it over time. But at some point, is the end life of every fine bottle of wine eventually to be consumed? Or do you see a world in which, you know, again, they just live as perpetual assets and no one really ever gets to experience them?
Yeah, that's a hot button topic, right? Because I would love to see every single bottle of wine consumed and enjoyed, right? That's what the winemaker intended it to do. Somebody enjoying it, you know, with friends, with family, and having a great time. However, sometimes it doesn't happen, right? You see a lot of times these sort of what we call unicorn bottles of wines from 1945 or from, you know, really even before the 20th century, they're being auctioned off for hundreds of thousands of dollars. What's happening there? So this means that it's really turned into a good that because it doesn't have any utility anymore, like no one's going to say that this 1945 bottle is better than something from, say, the 80s, or very few people will. It's really more turned into a piece of art or a piece of history because, you know, World War II, right? There's maybe only 5 or 10 of these bottles left. And it's so rare that people just want to put it up like it's art. So there is a certain point where the wine kind of reaches the end of its life of being actually tasty wine and starts becoming more of a sentimental collector's item.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just kind of thinking that, like, at the end of the day, does every bottle of wine need to eventually end up in a billionaire's hand where, you know, the cost of the bottle is immaterial? And so even if it, you know, was a very expensive bottle where eventually they would be compelled to consume it. You know, to that point, I guess, you know, you brought this up earlier and you know, I know you mentioned you have investment professionals. as well as also, you know, some algorithms to help you all make informed decisions on which wines to kind of invest in. What are some of the things though that you look for in the criteria? Like, what are some of those parameters that the team thinks about to help them understand how a bottle, case, or a spirit or a vintage might perform, especially over the longer term?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, we'll look on a regional basis, right? There are a few sort of huge markets for wine producing that we look at. So similarly to equities, obviously you've got the United States stock market, you've got the Asian stock market, you've got the European one. You know, United States, we've got Napa Valley. In Europe, we've got France, which is the biggest market. You've got Italy and Spain too. And then that's pretty much about it. There are sort of emerging markets that we look at. You know, that would be parts of South America that we're looking at right now. But those are the regions that we look at. Then when we drill down, we look at the actual wineries. So these wineries, they're usually producing multiple wines that are blue chip, and they're producing them every year. So you're able to start seeing patterns and comparisons on being like, all right, this winery's been producing wine for 50 years, right? You can start seeing trends and track records of being like, all right, when does the secondary market usually peak for this type of wine? Is it at year 15? Is it at year 20? Is it at year 25? And then we're looking at the different yearly variations, right? There's variations in the supply, in the yield that they're able to create, given on, you know, every year's weather conditions are different. Critic scores also play a role sometimes in the, at least the starting price of the wine. And then when they get rescored every 5 or 10 years, that can be akin to an analyst giving it a different rating, right? Going from, you know, AA to AAA, or, you know, a buy to a hold, right? Things like that, that we think are pretty important. And then lastly, it's going to be the speed of consumption. So we're able to look at, all right, how many bottles are in circulation on year 5, on year 10? And that's also a big factor for us. So all the things are parameters that our team looks at. And then on a macro level, there are things that can also materially impact wine. A recent example is the tariffs being lifted at the beginning of last year on all French imports into America. Before, all French wines had a 25% tax into the biggest consumption market for French wines, right? That materially impacts the pricing, the outlook for a lot of these French wines, and also maybe opens up the door for wines from other countries to start gaining traction, which is what happened. So we also look at those sort of factors that may affect, you know, many countries at once.
You know, you brought up where I was kind of going next too, which is, you know, as you do look and you provide, you know, you perform some of these analyses to kind of predict the best you can, you know, how the market will go. What are some of the risks that come up that really kind of cause a vintage, a winery, or anything to kind of, you know, not perform maybe the way that you might anticipate?
I think for us, the real risk for wine, other than the you know, storage and authentication risk that I mentioned, is on buying the purchase price, right? It's something that if you're buying something that is at the top, it's really going to be hard to have more long-term appreciation if you're buying something that is, you know, really hot. So like we rarely buy wines that have been after the critic score has named it like the best wine in the world, right? We know there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of short-term buzz. Usually it comes back down to the mean. So we try not to be too trigger happy with our decisions and really look at the long-term perspective.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you mentioned kind of this often, you know, how you guys authenticate some of these wines and some of the fraud. And you know, I think there's, I think I'm remembering a Netflix documentary called Sour Grapes that kind of just like related so much of this and is a great watch for those that haven't seen it. Very interesting. What are some of the protections that you all take to kind of help avoid that? And, you know, how prominent is kind of fraud and, you know, in the wine market? Especially, I only ask because, like, you know, in the documentary, it's all about monitoring the labels, right? Because like no one is opening the wine to actually taste it. So it's kind of like a hard process overall. So maybe you can walk everyone through that.
With wine, I think because a lot of this wine is transactive and people aren't actually opening it to taste it, it is difficult. So a lot of times you want to know that it is in what we call OWC, which means original wooden case. The wine is in the same case that the winery released it in, and a lot of times they're banded. So you want to see that there's a band on that case. You want to see that there is an original wooden case. When you open it, there are certain sort of labels that also have ultraviolet signals on them. So we're able to see like, all right, you know, do they have the ID code. Can the ID code match back to what the winery said it was? And things like that. And different wineries have different sort of fraud prevention measures. And we've become familiar with them, and the teams at the storage facilities have become familiar with them to be able to detect that. And that is really, I think, crucial when we're buying from third-party sources, which is why more frequently than not, we'll actually just buy straight from the winery. There's no risk there. We know the winery, they're sending it directly to us. There's no sort of, you know, buying from a mysterious billionaire's seller, right? That's when things start to get a little bit sketchy.
That's interesting. So like the labels effectively become like, you know, like the US dollar currency, where you just have all these checkpoints or like your IDs nowadays, just to kind of prove some form of or at least make it more challenging for simple fraud.
Oh yeah. Some of these wineries get really creative with some of their fraud detection symbols. And it's they spend tens of thousands of dollars a year worrying about this because it really damages their brand.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So kind of getting back then to kind of, you know, we were talking a little bit about the life cycle of these kind of wines. When you all are buying and selling, you mentioned obviously the buy side might very often be direct to a winery. Is that usually the, you know, the most current kind of batch? Or, you know, do they also hold back, you know, some vintages from 15 years or so ago? And then maybe also walk everyone through, like, let's say, you know, in some of your managed funds, and you want to sell out of a position, who is the next step of buyers kind of for, you know, in this market, especially if you're buying in large scale, I imagine, you know, cases and cases at a time, as opposed to, you know, just single bottles or smaller quantities?
Yeah, two great questions. So to answer the first, we do see that wineries like to release wines on special anniversaries that are a little bit older. So maybe they've held back something from 2015 or 2010 and they're doing a release today. Right, that means that there's already built-in price appreciation. That's sort of what we call the winery's treasury, right? They know that on a rainy day, they've always got their sort of old reserves that they can release into the market and be able to get cash flow quickly. So we do like to do that as well, because it also helps us reduce risk. You know, we're getting these older bottles that have matured a few years, but they're direct from the winery, so they're in perfect condition rather than getting something on the secondaries. And then when you're looking at rebalancing a portfolio, right? Someone may need to get out of their position earlier than expected due to whatever they need in life. Then we're able to work with the market, right? It's something that hasn't reached maturity. It's probably someone just looking to take over and continue to store that and still be able to reap the remaining upside. Or if it is closer to maturity, the chances are that the counterparty is a consumer is going to be larger.
Okay, very cool. And so I know how much it varies, but maybe you could walk everyone through a little bit around, you know, what some of the prices are that are paid on either a per bottle or a case basis. And if it is on a case basis, just kind of how many bottles typically come in a wine case. But just kind of curious, you know, like what type of volume do you all kind of need here?
Yeah, so we'll go per bottle just to make it easier. So for a standard 750 milliliter bottle on Vinovest, we're seeing things from, say, just around $100 range to our most expensive bottle, I think is around $54,000 that we sold recently. Those are the ones that have minuscule production. They're aged. They just have a legendary status and they just don't make that much wine. So that's a pretty big range to deal with. So for investors who are just starting out, right, they're probably looking to drop a few thousand dollars in, you know, buy a few, you know, maybe a case or two of these couple hundred dollar a bottle type of wines, and then build their way up. But the fascinating thing is there is upside at different price points. So you don't need to invest in the ultra expensive wines to enjoy the historical returns that we really see in wine.
And, you know, I guess I just don't know this. Like what is the most expensive bottle of wine that's ever been transacted on a per bottle basis? And yeah, I guess kind of how frequent are those really massive $55,000 or so tickets, either on platform or even in the market overall?
Yeah. So the most expensive recent transaction, I think, was at a Sotheby's or a Christie's auction house in Hong Kong. It was a bottle of 1945 DRC. So that stands for Domaine de la Romanée Conti, which is that super crazy expensive bottle that I was talking about. And I think it was like a three bottle lot. So three bottles, and it was almost like $500,000 a bottle. Crazy.
Yeah. Good on them. Okay. One of the other things, you know, I just want to kind of go circle back to, and you kind of mentioned, you know, like these really strong, you know, historical geographies, right? The France, Spain's, Italy's of the world, and certainly, you know, more recently, the Napa's and California. And I think you'd mentioned those are kind of like some of the core markets that everyone thinks about for wine. Typically, when you think of kind of like really developed areas and markets, and then you think about some of the more emerging spaces, some of the fastest growth tends to happen, or appreciation can happen in those emerging markets. Mm-hmm. But typically with more risk and all those other, you know, caveats as well. I'm kind of curious, in the wine market, you know, are there really strong emerging regions that are coming that are really seeing like phenomenal growth in some of their wines? Or is it really, if you want the growthy names, you kind of still have to stay in the core markets with, you know, whether it's limited supply or really proven wineries, kind of all those thoughts?
I think with wineries, when you spot an emerging market, you can kind of spot it from 5 years away because of the sort of long-term nature of wine, right? You do need to age it for 5, 10, 15 years to even see if it's any good, right? If a lot of times a measure of a good winery is how age-worthy its wines are. So there's no sort of like explosive overnight success or came out of nowhere. Sometimes that may happen if there's a change of ownership, right? You can get a hot new winemaker under the helm of a winery. He kind of just completely transforms it and starts creating amazing wine. So that can happen in some cases, but usually it's the blue chips, right? And recently I'd say the two hottest regions are going to be Champagne and Burgundy. And a lot of the reason is because of really volatile weather that they're experiencing there. So climate change is really playing a huge role in these traditionally still very blue chip regions, but kind of giving them some extra flames, so to say, onto the market and the demand.
Well, kind of to that point, right? Like people, like you think about like Dom Perignon, right? Like only produce kind of a batch. And if I might have this wrong, correct me, like every so often. I don't think they've done anything since like 2008 and 2009. And I think a lot of that is due to kind of like the weather and the climate factors. But like, what are some of the factors that kind of go into making good wine? And then also, how do you kind of know in real time, right? So you see seasonal weather or, you know, for any year, you kind of have a good understanding of what the weather was. How much of a predictor does that lead one to believe for 5 years out or 10 years out when the wine's actually or champagne's aging? How much do you kind of know now versus how much do people just uncork 5 years from now and find out it's a bad year?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not a winemaker, so this may get a little bit over my head, but I think it's a lot of the chemistry, because if you look at some of the chemical compounds in wines that age really well, they all have higher acidity levels. That's what allows the wine to be able to have, I think, a little bit more of a mellowed aging process. And beginning, it may be a little bit too astringent for drinkers. And it has, I think, the tannins to also give the wine structure. So, you know, a lot of times if you open the wine, it's gone bad. You know, it tastes flabby. It's something that just tastes very flat a lot of the times. And the tannins and the good structure of acidity are sort of, from an objective standpoint, usually pretty good measuring sticks. And you can see that, you know, right when you're kind of harvesting, right? You can go to the lab, take some samples, be like, all right, whoa, like, you know, maybe the sugar levels are too high. Maybe that's going to lead to elevated alcohol. And if there's not enough balance in the acidity to be able to counteract a very high alcohol content, that's going to overpower the rest of the wine. It's going to be flabby, not good, right? So those are some things that winemakers, especially with recent years technologies, can do better to manage their harvest. You know, maybe they'll pick a little bit earlier, right? To kind of maintain a little bit less sugar content in the grape, which is now what a lot of winemakers are doing. And what's that causing? That's causing them to pick when the harvest is at a lower yield and release at lower supply.
And kind of to that point, what sort of really, so you mentioned obviously there's some chemistries and certainly some predictable natures of kind of what the output will be based on the chemistries. But what really differentiates then the blue chip wineries versus everyone else? If kind of, you know, again, a lot of the information is the same, what really differentiates them? Is it the grapes? Is it the soil? What kind of really changes, you know, winery to winery, especially in the same region?
Yeah, it's really the soil, because even in the same region like Napa, there's a lot of smaller, what we call microclimates, and the soil is not the same. Like the composition of the soil, the way the sun hits the land, the, you know, the way the wind runs through the vineyard, and then all of those things are really small differences that are almost immeasurable. But over time, those things add up, and those become something that is built into the brand, right? A lot of times it's all about, you know, what they call the terroir, you know, what's in the land that is really important. And a lot of the greatest winemakers in the world, they're very humble. They're like, I do nothing. I just let the land, you know, be, right? They're just kind of caretakers of the land, and it produces what it produces.
It's honestly amazing. I mean, can they manipulate the land and the soil in any way? Or is it pretty much, you know, like the plot that they got is going to be very much the determining factor in the quality of the wine, plus obviously their expert ability to kind of, you know, harvest and everything else?
Yeah, they can certainly rejuvenate the land, because I think, you know, especially I think in the last half century, you know, the Industrial Revolution, people were trying to get as much juice out of the grapes. People were trying to spray chemicals on it to make the grapes hardier. And they realized that it had an adverse effect on the wine, right? All of those things kind of seeped into the final flavors. And now a lot of these winemakers are going back to more sustainable, biodynamic, organic practices, really kind of nourishing the soil and creating a diverse and, you know, ecosystem around the land so that it can survive and be, I think, a little bit hardier to climate change in a more natural way. So we are seeing a ton of these top wineries start to go back to basics, so to say, and really look at a long-term approach, you know, really take a really natural approach. And that's, I think, leading to better results in the wine as well.
Very cool. I've got another question that I've been meaning to ask, and I haven't gotten to it yet, but knowing the explosive growth of some of these wines, certainly a lot of the vineyards, I imagine, you know, have revenues based on actually selling the wines in the first place, but they're clearly giving up on a ton of the potential profitability and gains of the wines that they themselves are producing. How do they sort of think through and make all that equate, knowing that just by holding onto the vintages themselves or some of the supply, certainly there'd be hopefully a larger market over time for them to sell into, especially with this more exponential growth?
Yeah, I think it's on the minds of a lot of wineries, but just given the nature of an agricultural business with very high operational expenses, they're always, or most of the time, they're very cash poor, right? They've got a lot of assets, the equipment, the land, you know, the workers, the storage, right? Of all these barrels that are still fermenting. And they do try to hold back when they can, right? And release it at later times. But just given how the nature of the business is, they need it for the next harvest, right? They need it to fix the equipment that broke during this harvest, and they need that cash now.
Okay, cool. You know, last thing on my mind here, and I want to turn it over to you for any kind of parting thoughts. And certainly if you want to kind of walk everyone through a little bit more about Vinovest and really ways that they can kind of, you know, potentially get involved, is really just around kind of like we see across, you know, global economies over and over again, this massive consolidation across a lot of different industries as well. Where is the consolidation potential in wineries? And is that really something that's a trend that you're seeing? Or is it really just like, these bespoke wineries are just doing everything that they can to stay independent, just knowing that you mentioned obviously a lot of, you know, overhead and fixed costs in some respects?
Yeah, I think traditionally you know, the wine industry is one that really has embraced tradition. And with that, right, it's a lot of mom and pops. It's the land that their grandpa's grandpa gave them, and this is their life's mission to continue. You do see some conglomerates, right? LVMH is a big famous one. They pretty much own all of the top champagne houses and a lot of the top chateaus in Bordeaux as well. And then you see ones, I think, a little bit more downstream in the market. So not your blue chip wines, but more of your kind of like, you know, everyday like $10, $12 bottles, you know, your Constellations, Gallows of the world. We're seeing a lot of transactions and mergers in that realm. But I think a lot of these really top wineries are fiercely independent. And that, I think, brings its own challenges, but they have the freedom, right? A lot of times people are in the wine industry not just for the money. A lot of times for the lifestyle, right? Being able to live on a vineyard, drink wine every day, and greet people who are interested in your wines, it's kind of the dream if you're into that, right? And I think that's something that they want to keep independent without having to worry about, you know, P&L and marketing budget and things like that.
Yeah, especially when you consider it to be, I would imagine, to many winemakers, an art as much as anything else, for which, you know, while we consider them passion assets, they're also very passionate about the businesses that they're creating and what they're producing overall. Anthony, I want to turn it to you. You know, as mentioned, you know, certainly any other thoughts kind of on Vinovest or anything else that you kind of wish we covered that we didn't?
No, I mean, alt assets, I think, are a huge and really fascinating space. And there's something for everybody, I think. whether it be investing in wine or art or something else, I think the modern portfolio is continuing to shift and going to be favoring more and more untraditional, passion assets. And I think the more that, companies like ours can make these assets more accessible to users, I think the better off we'll be. So really appreciate the time that you've given me today to talk all about my favorite subject.
I was about to say, I enjoy all of our conversations, but there's ones where, they're just really unique and interesting, especially when you think about, how wine's created and something that's so commonplace, but also so complex, especially when you think about the different areas of the market. So Anthony, again, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, of course, also to all of our listeners. Remember to visit www.yieldstreet.com to learn more. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. And thank you so much and see you soon.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.